Good afternoon, good church. Thank you for the warmest of welcomes that we have already received. It is a privilege and a blessing to be with you. As Dan mentioned, we're a family of four. It's myself, my husband John, and our two daughters, Isabel and Noelia. But I dare say, in fact, we're a family of five. The fifth member of our family is about that big. Is a tiny orange ball of fluff called Bella. Bella is a toy poodle, and everybody that has met Bella has been blessed by her ferocious friendliness. She will devour anybody with licks and kisses. She is utterly adorable. And Bella often travels with me in the car when I need to go somewhere. A couple of weeks ago, I was driving to Sainsbury's. I was in rather a rush, as I have a bad habit of being. And on my way to Sainsbury's to do many things, I saw Bella curled up on the seat next to me in the car, on the front seat next to me, asleep. Bella likes three things. She loves three things. She likes many, many things. She loves three things. She likes sleep, she likes food, and she likes walkies. Now, before we had left, she had had food. She was having a nice nap on the front seat of the car. And I could hear in my mind the metaphorical voice of Bella saying, "Lana, Lana, you are anxious with many things, but there is only one thing that is necessary for my joy to be complete, and that is walkies." So, swayed by my guilt and the fact that it was a beautiful, sunny autumn day, I stopped off at the woods, still in a rush, but to go for a quick walk. So we jumped out of the car, I hooked Bella onto the lead, at which she was tugging at mercilessly, and we stomped off into the woods. I was thinking, 15 minutes and I can still get everything done, we'll just whiz round. Because Bella was continuing to tug at the lead, I bent down to let her off. The woods that I had stopped at are rather large. They're far from the road. It's a peaceful place that I enjoy. I thought, well, this is fine. I can just let her run around. So I've bent down to let Bella off the lead. And when I've stood back up, I've been stopped dead in my rush and in my haste by what to me in that moment was an utterly surprising sight. There was nothing, and yet there was everything. The woods that I was in it being a beautiful autumn day, there were all of these trees stood upright. There was a squirrel, there was a Bella chasing the squirrel. There was the sun coming through the canopy. And for just a moment, I was awestruck by something that, as I stand here, I cannot really express to you. But I suspect you know the feeling. When you sense, when you discern, when you feel, when you can nearly touch such beauty that you wonder how you can apprehend it, how you can hold on to it. So, of course, I reached for my phone. I thought, I'll take a photo. But before my hand made it to my phone, I thought, actually, I won't take a photo because the photo really won't be able to capture what I am enjoying, what I am being blessed by, what I am being filled by. Because it's not the tree to my right, and it's not the tree to my left, and it's not the leaves and their crunch underfoot. It's not even the canopy or the breeze. It's not the squirrel. It's not the very cute dog. It's not the sun shining through. It is all of those things together, that come together, that come together in a way that I can scarcely understand, to produce an effect that is much greater than what I see or what I smell or what I hear. I stood there, breathing it in. And in a moment, it was gone. A lorry on the distant road drove down. The dog barked. But I had had that flash. And a quote came to mind. Oh. Thank you. This is a quote by C.S. Lewis. He says, "At present, we are on the outside of the world, the wrong side of the door. We discern the freshness and purity of morning, but they do not make us fresh and pure. We cannot mingle with the splendors we see." There's something that happens when we experience moments of beauty and then they fly away from us. We're left with this yearning to mingle. We want to step into that moment and abide there. We want to step into that presence and abide there. And Lewis here is speaking about this frustration that we feel because we can see, we can sense, we can discern, we can intuit. We can nearly taste what peace and belonging and joy should feel like. But we cannot seize it. We cannot own it. It somehow lies beyond our grasp. But we do try. We do strive to grasp for it. We do strive by our many actions and undertakings and plans. We do strive to hold it, to own it, to create it. And yet somehow, as the famous song goes, we can't get no satisfaction, though we try, 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 and try, and try. So I wonder what Jesus has to say about this intuition that we have, that we should be able to hold on to, abide in profound beauty, and yet by our struggles and our striving, we cannot hold on to it. I wonder if a poor carpenter from 2,000 years ago has something to say to me in 2025, walking through the woods and wanting to hold on to that moment. What does Jesus say to that feeling of being on the wrong side of the door? This feeling that we're locked out, but we want to get in. Into what? The Word of God, the Scriptures, tell us many things. And this is one that I wanted to start with. It's Jesus saying, "Listen." Some versions, some translations say, "Behold." Others say, "See." "I am standing at the door and knocking. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will enter into them and eat with them, and they with me." Notice that Jesus says, if anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will enter into them. It is not that we have been locked out of something that is out there. We have placed a door and Jesus is knocking on it. And the invitation is that we allow him to come in. come into our personhood, to come into our identity, to come into the very core of who we are. Which brings us to our topic today, the idea of Jesus, race, and ethnicity. When I learned that I would have the opportunity to speak on this topic, I did what everybody does, and I went to Google and I looked up what race and ethnicity is. And behold, I discovered something that I did not know. I had an assumption. I've never considered these words terribly closely, though they are present in so much of our lives and our experience. And I had an assumption that race and ethnicity were somehow tied to something tangible, something that you could measure, that they were an objective statement linked to reality. And from some of the faces I'm seeing, I'm not the only one. I mean, they do appear on census forms, don't they? So it feels they have an officialness to them. Turns out that race and ethnicity are completely subjective. They are created categories. Race is what other people say you are, based on physical characteristics. We lump people into boxes. And ethnicity is who we say we are, according to the culture or the community that we ascribe to. But both of them are our judgments on what is true and what is good. It's our way of understanding this vast breadth of human diversity, diversity in our appearance, diversity in our behavior, in our preferences, in our traditions, in our cultures, in our beliefs, in our languages. And we seek this unity, we seek togetherness, and we love to organize things. So we've created categories. They're reflections of our diversity and an attempt to find some unity in our diversity. But in Isaiah 53:6, it says, "All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way." As we create our categories, as we draw the lines of what is in and what is out, of what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is bad, we go each to our own way. And we find ourselves with a human family that is often fractured and at war. You don't have to go far to find examples of this. This image here is a giant canvas that would occupy a good chunk of that wall in reality. It was painted by Pablo Picasso in 1937, just before, a couple of years before the outbreak of the Second World War. A couple of months after the aerial bombing of a town in northern Spain, in a region called the Basque Country, where my mother was from, and it was bombed by Hitler and Mussolini in support of Franco, who was the dictator in Spain at the time, trying to impose his definition of what is right and what is wrong, and seeking a unity for all of Spain. He wanted to see the regions of Spain come under one neat, organized label. They would have a central government, and Hitler and Mussolini thought that this was a good plan. And this moment was one of the first aerial bombings, aeroplanes flying over and dropping bombs on a village. It was just a village. It was left absolutely desolate. And Picasso had been asked by the Spanish government, unrelated to this, had been asked by the Spanish government to paint a picture for an exhibition in Paris. And he was having a crisis, an artistic crisis. He couldn't find what to paint. And this tragedy moved him. If we compare this image to the image of the forest, and in the forest we have this glowing beauty. There is diversity there, but it is unified in some way. And yet, what Picasso expresses so powerfully here, as he seeks to express oppression and violence, what he does is he paints a picture of fracture, of things which are out of place, disjointed, twisted, distorted. As we impose ourselves on others, we create fracture. On the scale of a Franco or a Mussolini or a Hitler, the example is perhaps clear. But it's quite easy for us to say, I am no Franco. I have not aerial bombed a small village in the north of Spain. So I thought I would take the most innocuous of examples, the little white lie. We often hold the little white lie as a small thing which does no harm and often serves good. Without getting too philosophical, I wonder what it is that we do when we lie. Could it be that we are manipulating another person's view of reality so that we can control the outcome for a benefit that we say is good? When we represent something that we know is not true, we are trying to make another person view a false reality in service of an aim that we have, something that we have said, this is a good thing, therefore I can deny another person truth for it. Either by deceit or by sheer violence, we all have in us the tendency, the drive, the temptation to impose, to control others. To seek good on our terms. To make sure things get done the right way. And so we push people, we manipulate people, we deceive people. And some of us, I myself, do it so very well that we can even believe we're doing a good thing. But as I stand in the forest, seeing this beauty of interconnectedness, of interaction, that creates a synergy, that creates something that is greater than what I can name, how do I sit with that? I desire that. I try to create that in my life. I try to create order in my life. And yet what I often find is an image that looks a bit more like Picasso's. I often find moments of anger, frustration, disappointment, tension, things that just feel they've turned the wrong way. I'd like to take one of the teachings of Jesus that I think may be a surprising one to consider race and diversity, unity. In Mark's gospel, Mark tells the story of Jesus going into the temple. Let me read it to you. And they came to Jerusalem. And he, that's Jesus, he entered the temple and began to drive out those who sold and those who bought in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold pigeons. And he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. And he was teaching them and saying to them, "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations,' but you have made it a den of robbers?" Jesus has gone into the temple with his disciples, and he has seen people selling, exchanging money, which were in fact legitimate uses of the space. But something about what they were doing has caused Jesus to push back very hard on them. Very hard indeed. So hard that this is thought of by commentators in Mark's gospel as being a turning point. This passage sits between two very short narratives about the fig tree. Just before this passage, Jesus curses the fig tree. And just after this passage, we see the fig tree withered. And this image of a withering tree, it should be a tree that gives fruit. It should be nourishing, should have abundant life. But Jesus passes judgment on it and says it is withered and dry. And in the middle, we find God's people in the temple. The two things that Jesus says, one, that his house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations, and the other, that it has been made a den of robbers. Each of these phrases, Jesus is citing Old Testament prophets. With the first, that my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations, Jesus is citing Isaiah. And with the second, but you have made it a den of robbers, he's citing Jeremiah. In judgment of the people in the temple, Jesus refers to these two prophets, and they would have known the reference. This would have been meaningful to them. In the same way that if I cite the first line of a Taylor Swift song, any teenage girl right now will have the whole song immediately available, stored in memory. So these people in the temple, when they hear these words, know what Jesus is talking about beyond what these sentences say. I'd like to read for you from Jeremiah. It's a long passage. It's about 10 verses. So I haven't put it on the PowerPoint. Just listen to it with me. The word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord. "Stand in the gate of the Lord's house and proclaim there this word and say, 'Hear the word of the Lord, all you men of Judah, who enter these gates to worship the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your deeds, and I will let you dwell in this place. Do not trust in these deceptive words. This is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. For if you truly amend your ways and your deeds, if you truly execute justice with one another, if you do not oppress the sojourner, the fatherless, or the widow, or shed innocent blood in this place, and if you do not go after other gods to your own harm, then I will let you dwell in this place, in the land that I gave of old to your fathers forever. Behold, you trust in deceptive words to no avail. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, make offerings to Baal, and go after other gods that you have not known, and then come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, we are delivered, only to go on doing all these abominations? Has this house, which is called by my name, become a den of robbers in your eyes? Behold, I myself have seen it, declares the Lord. It's understandable, not justifiable, but it's understandable that the religious rulers plotted to kill Jesus after he declared in the temple that this is a den of robbers, because he has gone in and he has declared their religiosity, he has declared their piety void, empty. He has called it theft. He has called it murder. He has called it oppression. They were not selling pigeons for sacrifice. They were running a racket. They're making money. They're not helping people worship the Lord. They're helping themselves. And they're making it look like they're helping people worship the Lord. That is a den of robbers. They take refuge. They hide in the temple, call it piety, but in fact, they're seeking their own well-being at the cost of others. Yet the first phrase that Jesus announces is the divine vision for humanity, that the house of the Lord shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations. Israel was chosen by God to share God's love, not to block people from true worship, but to invite the nations, to invite everybody in. The word the nations in the original Greek and our modern day word ethnicity share the same linguistic root. Jesus is saying all ethnicities, everybody of every stripe, of every flavor, of every tendency should be able to come here and worship the Lord. There is a vision of a humanity united together in worship of our Creator. But Israel was failing in its commission. They had exchanged the truth of God, which He had given them, for lies of prosperity and activity. And a little like the comparison between Franco and our white lie, it's probably important that we meditate on the ways in which we fail to honor the truth of God in our daily choices, in our decisions, in the way we treat each other. Do we see other people as a means to our ends? Are we ready to judge another person as less in order to feel greater ourselves? Because the call is not that we would judge, but that we would love. The divine invitation is precisely the opposite. The sacrificial love of the Father is that we ascribe infinite value to another person, even if that be at cost to ourselves. The call of love is that we ascribe value, infinite value, to another person, even if it be at cost to ourselves. And that sits in stark contrast with our inclination to ascribe value to ourselves, even if it be at cost to another. There are two ethnicities. There are two cultures. There is God's culture of self-sacrificial love, and then there is not. And with every interaction with another person, with the decisions that we make in daily life, we are choosing our ethnicity. We are choosing God's culture or not. And we would do well to recognize that being here on a Sunday doesn't cut it. It's not what it's about. That is part of it. But what can we do? Not a lot, actually. I try to get it right most days, and the harder I try, the more wrong I seem to get it. It would seem we cannot strive to be good people because we find ourselves again in our own definitions of what good means. We are just people. But he is good, and he invites us to open the door and let him in, that he would come into us and be the goodness, that through him we would become truly human, truly whole. The quote that I read from C.S. Lewis earlier, there's another sentence. It is not just that we discern the freshness and purity of morning, but that it does not make us fresh and pure. It is not just that we cannot mingle with the splendors we see. There is more. Behold. Lewis says, all the leaves of the New Testament are rustling with the rumor that it will not always be so. There is an answer to our frustration. There is an answer to our struggle. There is a solution for our sin. There is a solution for the violence and the oppression that in ways both large and small, manifest and secret, we yield. Isaiah, I'm sorry the formatting didn't go very well in the transfer, but Isaiah also says a little more. He doesn't just say, all we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. He says, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. That fracture and that darkness that we generate precisely in trying to do what we think is good. There is a blessed answer for it. Before he went to the cross, where he would carry the iniquity of us all, where he would carry the ultimate fracture and separation from the Father, Jesus prays, and he says that the glory you have given me, I have given to them, that they may be one even as we are one, I in them and you in me, that they may become perfectly one, so that the world may know that you sent me and loved them even as you have loved me. Where Israel failed to tell the world of God's great love, Jesus has come. He has carried our iniquity, and he sends the Holy Spirit to dwell in us, that we may be perfectly one as a church and united in him with the Father. So that each one of us may have the divine capacity, receiving from him what we need, so that we would not try to extract it from each other or the world around us. If we first receive from him and he dwells in us, then we have the resources. We have a limitless, endless fountain of resources to ascribe value to each other, even if it be at cost to ourselves, because he has paid the cost. We are brought in so we can truly call each other family. We can give, we can bear patiently with one another, and we can look to him who will perfect us in trust, and we can receive from him all of those things that we need, so that we need not extract it from another. We can give freely as we freely receive. So if you feel as though the door is closed on you, but you can sense that there is beauty in the world, that there is more, and that you should somehow be able to apprehend it, let us not strive after the wind, but let us strive to enter his rest. Let our efforts be to receive him, not to work for our idea of righteousness. And let us receive one another in his name.